and to the left was the reception desk. Madame Mitchell made a beeline for it.
Norsted, Sanchez, Iceland, she called a minute later. Come get your room keys.
We were the only people staying three to a room, but that was because Hannah's dad had decided that only the penthouse suite was good enough for his little princess. I'd be sleeping on the pull-out sofa, but I didn't mind. I wasn't paying any extra, so I didn't have any reason to expect a bedroom of my own. The clerk held out a little envelope, marked 501, with three key cards inside, and Hannah snatched it from her.
Meet in the cafe at 8 for dinner, Madame Mitchell said. Peterson and Corbett, come get your keys.
Hannah, Pilar, and I started for the elevator, something I hadn't considered. The penthouse was on the 5th floor. My mind raced for an excuse to take the stairs, but I couldn't think of one. Finally, the door slid open. My heart sank even farther. It was the smallest elevator I'd ever seen, about the size of a bathroom stall.
Come on, Peely said. We'll squish.
I hesitated.
Colette? Hannah said.
Just then, I heard voices behind me. Audrey and Bryn were rolling their bags over, talking animatedly about the city. I half-stepped out of their way, and they got into the elevator before noticing that I was standing there.
Oh, sorry, Audrey said, seeing me. We'll get off and wait.
Nah, forget it. I rolled my bag over and shoved it in with the four of them. Can you just get my bag, Peely? I'll take the stairs.
Sure,
Pilar said. I took a second to catch my breath, and then I started the long climb. When I reached the top, Pilar stuck her head out of a door and waved. She'd left my suitcase in the hall, near the elevator, so I took it with me. Still panting, I dropped onto the sofa.
That's why you're so thin, Colette, Hannah said approvingly. That, and you don't just snack on whatever's sitting around.
Pilar had already unwrapped a piece of chocolate from the fancy welcome basket on the coffee table. When Hannah turned away, she tossed the chocolate into the trash can.
Let's explore, she said.
The penthouse was gorgeous, fit for a president or a queen. There were two bedrooms, each with a king-size bed piled with lush covers and overstuffed pillows, and its own bathroom, updated with gleaming white tiles and modern chrome fixtures. The living area was huge, with an additional bathroom off to the side and a beautiful flowered couch that converted to a pull-out bed, the one I'd be using. It was incredible, and Hannah and Pilar, used to being fabulously wealthy, moved around it like they owned the place, while I, as usual, felt like a complete fraud. The cost of the trip included meals from the prefix fixed price menu in the hotel's cafe. This was great for me, since I wouldn't have to spend every meal thinking about cost. But for Hannah, who never stopped to think about the pre of anything, much less care if it was fixed or not, this was a fact worth sighing over.
So, say a person didn't want to drown herself in fat and carbs, she said, staring dejectedly at the menu. What then?
I'm sure you can order from the regular menu, I said.
Yeah, if a waiter would ever bother to come by, she replied. I meant to warn you, Colette. This service in France is dismal, and the waiters hate Americans.
Our waiter wasn't dismal, nor did he seem to hate us. That is, until Hannah started bossing him around. Then he gazed down at us with a glare of disdain and took our orders without even the slightest hint of a smile. When he set our plates down with a series of unceremonious thunks, I gazed at the food.
I'd ordered a spinach and cheese quiche. Mom made quiches sometimes because they were pretty simple, a bunch of eggs and a pie crust. But with all due respect to my mother's cooking, her quiches were nothing like the one in front of me. This one was orangey golden, its surface a perfectly burnt brown, flecked with the green of the spinach. The crust was crispy but buttery. I cut a slice and took a bite. "Oh," I said, my mouth full of food. The rich, salty, cheesy flavor hit my tongue. "Oh my word. Is it good?" Pilar asked, eyes wide. She'd let Hannah peer pressure her into ordering a salad. I scooped a bite onto my fork and handed it to her. When she popped it into her mouth, her eyes closed, and she made a happy little hum sound. "You two act like you've never seen food before," Hannah said, carving at the grilled fish on her plate. "I haven't," I said. "Not food like this." She looked at me archly. "Just be careful. You don't want to fly home with your belly hanging over your waistband."
"My belly already hangs over my waistband," Pilar said. "Can I have another bite?"
I put half the quiche on a bread plate and handed it across to her, and we ate in near silence, relishing the flavor. Hannah clearly disapproved, but she didn't say another word about it. Even she couldn't resist the dessert plate, made up of cookies and macarons, colorful French pastries with a sweet filling sandwiched between two fluffy discs. Delicious and completely addictive. And then the waiter brought over a tray of cheese. Soft, melty, creamy cheese that practically collapsed on itself when you sliced it.
And we all ate that too.
By the time the meal was done, Hannah had the same food-glazed look in her eyes that Pilar and I did. "I'm totally not sorry," I said, heading back toward the stairs.
"Me neither," Peely said. "But I'm taking the elevator."
"Who am I kidding?" Hannah said, laughing. "I'm not sorry either. I'll start my diet tomorrow." When we got to the room, Hannah suggested we sneak out to some local cafes, but Pilar was already changing into her pajamas, and I couldn't stop yawning. So we decided to call it a night, and a few minutes later, I was snuggled under the covers of the pull-out couch. Despite the fact that I hadn't slept in more than a day, I lay awake for a while, staring at the ceiling. The French ceiling, I thought. I didn't want to waste 1 minute of my trip not remembering that I was in Paris, that the food I ate was Parisian food, that the people I met were actual French people, and that the ground I walked on was the most magical and romantic ground in the world. The only thing that wasn't absolutely perfect was a tiny, nagging sense of unease about something, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was. So I turned onto my side and closed my eyes, resolving to put any unnamed worries out of my mind for the next 8 days. Chapter 4.
"Who are we waiting on?" Madame Mitchell asked.
We were in the hotel lobby, ready to walk to the Saint-Michel station, where we'd catch a commuter train to our first official French destination, the Royal Palace at Versailles. "Hannah and Pilar," Audrey said. "Surprise, surprise." Although the way Audrey presented herself to the world physically was cringeworthy, you had to admire the way she spoke her mind without worrying who she ticked off. Madame Mitchell turned to me, pushing her reading glasses up onto the bridge of her nose.
"Any idea when they'll be down?"
"As if I had any influence over them?" I shrugged. It had taken me about 15 minutes to get ready. I wore a gray sweater, a cream-colored corduroy skirt, a pair of gray tights, and knee-high dark brown walking boots. Based on what I'd observed on the street yesterday, I kept my hair simple, pulling it back in a low bun, and my makeup minimal. Pale brown eyeshadow, light blush, and pink lips. No mascara. My only accessories were a pair of small silver hoop earrings and the medallion I'd found in the old box back home. It hung from its ribbon around my neck. I'd tried to convince Hannah and Peely that French women were lower maintenance than your typical Ohio prep school student, but they both insisted on performing their usual elaborate grooming rituals. Versailles has been there for almost 400 years, Hannah said, plugging in her flat iron as I hurried to load my day bag. I'm sure it can wait another few minutes. Finally, I gave up and left them so I could eat breakfast and meet the rest of the group by 9. They came strolling into the lobby together at 9:14. Hannah had meticulously straightened her hair and wore gobs of makeup. She was in one of her doubtless brand new outfits, a dark blue mini dress with a flared skirt and wide bell sleeves, paired with 4-inch heels and a Marc Jacobs handbag the size of a small car. Pilar had gelled her curly hair into a bazillion shiny ringlets and wore a pair of skinny jeans with a voluminous bright pink poncho-style top. On her feet were 3-inch cork platforms.
"Are you going to be able to walk in those shoes, girls?"
Madame Mitchell asked, one eyebrow raised.
"I hope so," Pilar said. "These are the lowest heels I brought."
Hannah flashed a disdainful smile.
"I can walk in anything."
But after 2 blocks, we all had to stop and stand around for 10 minutes while Hannah went into a shoe store and bought a pair of knee-high flesh-toned boots. At least after that, we could move at a normal pace. "This is ridiculous," Hannah said, coming up alongside me. "They need to repave these streets so people can wear real shoes." "Oh, sure," I said. "Hundreds of years of history should totally get covered up so you can wear your Jimmy Choos." I'd meant it as a joke, but her sharp look stung me like a hornet.
"They weren't Jimmy Choo's, Colette," Pilar said, a gentle rebuke in her voice. "They were Louboutins."
"At least Pilar and I don't look like we just rolled out of bed," Hannah said hotly.
I didn't let the comment bother me too much. She was only angry because she'd been forced to admit she was wrong. Looking around, it was obvious that I blended in, while Pilar and Hannah stuck out like a pair of overdone poodles on a hiking trail.
"Where are we going anyway?"
Hannah's voice was sour.
"To the train station," Pilar said. "It's not much farther."
Hannah rolled her eyes.
"Well, I've got my clodhoppers on now, so that doesn't matter."
I cast a glance at Hannah's clodhoppers, which had probably cost $400.
"I think we should turn left here," Audrey said.
She was walking next to the teacher, directly in front of us. Madame Mitchell followed Audrey's advice without a moment's hesitation, which made Hannah murmur, "Loser," under her breath. Pilar laughed, and I stayed silent. But I could tell by the way Audrey's shoulders went rigid that she'd heard what Hannah said.
The Saint-Michel station served both Paris's subway and the commuter rail lines. We stopped near the antique Art Deco Metro sign while Madame Mitchell looked around for our tour guide. Someone tapped me on the shoulder, and I found myself looking into the bright blue eyes of a guy a few years older than me.
"Pardonnez-moi. Mais c'est un groupe de Louvaises étranger qui fait une visite guidée," he said.
"What?" I said. "I mean, pardon?"
His eyebrows went up in surprise.
Oh, you are with the group. I thought you were French. I was telling you that you were mixed in with a bunch of Americans.
I stared at him, not knowing what to say. He thought I was French. An actual French person thought I was French.
He gave me a quick smile and walked over to Madame Mitchell.
Girls,
she said. She flapped a red handkerchief above her head.
Écoutez, voici votre guide.
That's him? That is our hot French tour guide?
Hannah's face fell. I want my money back. It was true that this guy looked nothing like the way you'd imagine a dashing European university student to look. I guess we'd all been hoping for Pilar's vampire. Someone tall and slim, with an angular jaw and sexy, unkempt hair. Someone pale and artistic. Someone French-looking. Our guide had tan skin and neatly groomed dark blonde hair. He wore a red hoodie, a black t-shirt, and jeans. His shoes, gray Pumas, weren't bulky white sneakers, but they weren't exactly sleek leather Oxfords, either.
Mademoiselles,
Madame Mitchell said.
Je vous présente Jules Martin.
Jules Martin. Only she pronounced his name Jules Martin, which, I had to admit, seemed a little exotic for the boy standing in front of us. There was nothing wrong with him, exactly. He just looked kind of American. Hannah crossed her arms, disgusted. What a waste of time.
Bonjour, ladies, Jules said.
At least his accent is cute, Pilar whispered. So we're supposed to tour Paris with our eyes closed? Hannah replied.
Yes, definitely, I said. That's the best way to see the city.
Jules glanced over at us, and his expression made me suddenly ashamed. It was this glazed look that told me he wasn't seeing us as people, but as a stereotypical group of silly teenage girls. I half pivoted away from my friends, but it seemed like too little too late. He led us down into the station. I was nervous when I saw that we had to go underground, but soon we were in a wide open terminal. Madame Mitchell passed out our tickets, and we all sat together on the top level of the train. Hannah took the window seat. Another unspoken Hannah rule. If there was a window seat, she got it. And Peely sat next to her. I went to the next row back and sat down, picking up a newspaper some commuter had left behind. As I folded it, I caught a glimpse of the headline.
Brutalité. L'assassinat de 12 ados de famille distinguée.
Right. The murders our van driver had mentioned. I shivered as I glanced at the photos of the two victims, Gabrielle Roux and Pierre Beauclair. Gabrielle was gorgeous, and Pierre was alluring in the way we'd hoped our tour guide would be. I squinted at their faces for a moment, trying to figure out why they looked familiar. Then Pilar turned around.
Comment allez-vous?
She trilled. She's bien, Hannah said, turning around us. What else would she be? I tried to smile.
Très bien.
But I felt like the faces on the folded-up newspaper were watching me, all the way to Versailles. It was a two-block walk from the train station to the palace. Jules spent much of it walking backward, talking about the French monarchy.
Versailles was originally a hunting lodge, until King Louis XIV, the Sun King, moved the royal court and French government here in 1682.
Do I have a lipstick on my teeth? Hannah asked, tugging my sleeve.
Of course. The monarchy was abolished during the revolution, beginning in the year 1789. When the Jacobins stormed the palace and captured the royal family.
Pilar stopped for a second.
Hang on. There's a piece of gravel in my shoe.
King Louis XVI and his queen, Marie Antoinette, were both imprisoned.
Have you ever been out here, Pilar? Hannah asked.
No, I...
Shh,
I said to them both, and they were quiet.
Beheaded,
Jules said. He paused.
Any questions?
You don't seriously care about all this boring stuff, do you, Colette? Hannah sniffed. We're not supposed to be learning.
Jules went on talking, but I gave up trying to hear him. Instead, I let Pilar lean on me because her feet were already sore, and I held Hannah's purse while she dug through it looking for her $800 Bulgari sunglasses. But when we turned the corner and the palace came into view, even Hannah was struck dumb. It was as big as a shopping mall and covered in ornate stonework and metal accents, with wings the size of slightly smaller shopping malls on either side. In the center was a gigantic cobblestone courtyard that had once, Jules said, bustled with the activities of the royal court. Separating us from the palace grounds was a fence of gleaming yellow gold, impossibly vivid against the pale blue sky. I looked from one side to the other and thought, my family might have come here. Maybe they even walked on these same cobblestones.
In front of us is the main palace, Jules said. Behind it lie the world-famous gardens. Farther off, you will find the private residences of the king and queen, Le Grand Trianon and Le Petit Trianon. Past Le Petit Trianon,
his voice faded out of my mind as I tried to imagine what it would be like to cross the bumpy courtyard in a horse-drawn carriage, knowing that when the carriage stopped, there would be an army of servants to help you out, carry your things, bow down to you. I could practically feel the weight of a gown on my hips, a powdered wig on my head.
Earth to Colette, Hannah said. We have to go get our tickets.
Right, I said, snapping out of it. After we crossed through the metal detectors, Madame Mitchell gave us the okay to split up, but threatened us with certain death if we failed to meet back by the entrance at 5 p.m. on the dot.
Are you listening, Hannah and Pilar? She said.
No, Hannah said under her breath. But Pilar nodded and gave the teacher a thumbs up. Then we were on our own. Hannah declared that first we would walk through the main house. Only she could look at this place and call it a house. And then we'd venture onto the grounds when the day got a bit warmer. The wings contained a series of rooms, one leading to the next like links on a chain. You could imagine someone spending a whole morning lounging on the brocade sofas and satin chairs as they waited for their audience with the king. The walls were covered in jewel-toned panels of silk, with huge oil paintings and carved marble busts everywhere. Hannah didn't linger. She entered a room, looked around, and then started for the exit on the other side. I tried to take a few pictures, but it was hard to keep up with her pace. Finally, we stopped at the entrance to a grand expanse of a hallway. The Hall of Mirrors, Pilar said, reading from her map. The room was as long as a football field, lined with gigantic mirrors, soaring arched windows, and classical statues. Hanging from the ceiling must have been 40 crystal chandeliers. Thinking of the work that would have gone into creating such a place made me feel still and silent. It was a work of art, a masterpiece that you could actually walk right into. And once upon a time, people had lived here, walked through it as they discussed their dogs, or what they were having for dinner, or who'd looked fat in her ball gown the previous night. I felt a tightening in my chest, a sharp spike of intense sadness,
almost like nostalgia. Except it was for a life I'd never lived.
So, Hannah said, suddenly turning on us. I didn't want to say anything before now, but I talked to my dad this morning, and everything's settled.
Settled? I glanced at Pilar to see if she was in on it, whatever it was. But she seemed lost, too. Hannah wore the beginning of an incredibly self-satisfied smile.
Next Saturday.
She paused for what felt like 5 minutes.
We're coming to a party here.
A party? Here? Whose party? Pilar asked.
It's being given by the embassy, Hannah said. And Dad's friend got us on the list. Just the three of us.
No way, Pilar said. Then she gave a little hop and then a bunch of hops that ended with her arms around Hannah's shoulders in a tight hug. No way, no way. Are you serious?
Hannah backed out of the embrace.
No, I'm joking.
Of course I'm serious. It's Saturday night, and it's a costume ball, and we're going to have a limo come and pick us up at the hotel. I mean, whatever French people consider a limo.
Pilar stared at her, open-mouthed. Hannah turned to me.
Well, Colette, you usually have something to say for yourself.
It's going to be amazing. I was still in shock. My voice sounded like someone had let the air out of it. I can't believe it.
Hannah, gratified by my reaction, deigned to give me a warm smile. And only for my besties, she said. Remember that, because you guys are special.
Hidden in her compliment was a buried threat. Specialness, in Hannah's eyes, was something that could be taken away as easily as it had been granted. One thing was for certain. I was going to spend the week on my best behavior. We continued through the Hall of Mirrors. Knowing we would be coming back to Versailles for a gala event made every gleaming surface glow that much brighter. My skin prickled with excitement. At one point, I found myself alone in a quiet stretch of the room, apart from Hannah, Pilar, and the tourist groups. I stopped and looked into the mirror, wondering how many countless people had stared into it over the centuries. I let my eyes focus on its clouded surface rather than my own face, and was overcome for a moment by a dizzy, disoriented feeling. A flash of movement behind my reflection brought me back to the present, and I caught a glimpse of a woman in full period costume among the crowd. Her pale pink dress was almost ridiculous in its proportions, wide from the front and narrow from the sides. It was impeccably adorned with ruffles and bows and gathers and lace. Her hair was piled high on her head, small tendrils hanging down, with a jaunty little V-shaped hat placed in such a way that three massive white feathers arced over her right shoulder.
Wow, I whispered, turning to get a better look at her. But when I scanned the room, she was gone.
Then a massive wave of tourists approached like a wall of water. I could imagine the poor woman trapped in the center of the group, mobbed by people eager to add picture with costume character to their list of French accomplishments, as if this were Disney World. Pilar called my name from the exit doorway, and I hurried to catch up. I couldn't stop thinking about the woman as we continued through the rest of the main palace. And even though I knew Hannah would tell me to forget about her, I kept checking behind us to see if she'd reappeared. I was desperate to see her up close, not just because of her clothes,
which I would love to get a closer look at. But because of what I was almost positive I'd seen around her neck, a medallion, just like mine. The lush green grounds were as impressive as the palace itself. They stretched on as far as the eye could see. A wide gravel path ran down the center, bordered by trees whose branches were groomed into impossibly straight vertical lines. The view was broken up by spraying fountains and enormous ponds reflecting the sky. Hannah, Pilar, and I stopped for lunch at a little open-air restaurant next to the reflecting pool. I ordered a ham and brie baguette, creamy cheese, and salty ham sandwiched between two pieces of bread so crusty they scraped the roof of my mouth. As we ate, we saw the rest of our group pass by us and start down the side road that led to the Grand and Petit Trianons, the king and queen's private residences.
"I'm gonna hit the ladies' room," Hannah said.
Pilar stood up too, and then they waited for me, as if we were chained together. "I actually need to ask Madame Mitchell something," I said. "I'm going to try to catch them, okay? Then I'll double back."
"They must be halfway there by now," Hannah said. "Just wait for us at the Grand Trianon."
"Okay," I said, although that wasn't even where I wanted to go. "But what if I don't find you?"
"I'm going to pee my pants," Pilar said. "I think I drank too much coffee."
Hannah looked exasperated.
"Colette, we'll either see you there or we won't. Now, if you'll excuse us, Pilar needs to potty."
I nodded and started down the path, trying to look like I was rushing to find our teacher. But as soon as Hannah and Peely were out of sight, I slowed down and felt a small, triumphant glow. Because I wasn't trying to catch up with anybody. I was just trying to get away from my friends. Managing to do so with Hannah's express permission was like a bonus. I couldn't explain why, but I wanted to be alone. And now I had the whole afternoon to myself. I followed the long, tree-lined path toward Le Petit Trianon. The building was beautiful, but it was small and boxy and almost plain. I mean, certainly not small relative to where I now lived, but to people like Hannah and Pilar, this place might not be completely awe-inspiring. Inside, I got the same impression. Compared to the all-out opulence of the main palace, it felt cozy and intimate. There was still plenty of grandeur. Plaster carvings on the walls, floors of checkerboard marble tile, and a chandelier hanging above the grand staircase, but also a vibe of privacy and closeness. You could see how a person would feel more at home here, like she had her own little space. There were hardly any tourists, so I had time to linger, stopping in each doorway to look around before wandering into the next room. The air was still, but there was an underlying energy. It felt quiet, but not empty. Kings and queens walked here, I thought, looking over what had once been a billiards room. As I turned to move on, I caught a flash out of the corner of my eye, a shape moving outside the window. I peered through the glass but saw nothing except a flock of sheep grazing on a distant pasture and a pair of old ladies wandering down a winding dirt path. But I could have sworn I'd seen a pale pink dress. As I stepped back from the window, I noticed that it had an elaborate metal handle with a lock. And carved on the lock was the same spiky flower that was cut out of the key in my medallion. Checking the other windows revealed that each one had the same fancy lock, and on each lock was the same flower carving. I felt my throat tighten almost imperceptibly. I headed upstairs, following a path through a series of little rooms, dining rooms, game rooms, music rooms, and stopping at the queen's bedroom. Every piece of fabric, the curtains on the windows, the bedspread, the drapes around the bed, and even the chairs, featured a white background with tiny sprays of little blue flowers, each petal ending in a delicately spiked fork. It wasn't exactly the same as the design on the medallion. It was missing the key. But the flower being featured so prominently definitely raised my curiosity. Had the Iceland family, my family, had some real connection to the royals? A door to my left led to a small square room with walls of light blue, decorated with white carvings like the frosting on a cake. There didn't seem to be any windows, but on each wall was a large gold-rimmed mirror. I stepped into the room and saw myself reflected a million times. I spun in a slow circle, taking in the smell of polished wood and that hard-to-pin-down scent that just meant old. As I completed my turn and glanced at my reflection, I froze. The face in the mirror wasn't my own. The eyes were set a little wider, there was a widow's peak in the center of the forehead, and the lips were fuller. I was so captivated by the odd sight that I hardly had time to realize that it wasn't just the face that was different. None of what was reflected was me, unless I'd somehow changed into a floor-length black dress. I stumbled backward, and for a moment the mirrored room was like a funhouse. I lost my bearings and couldn't tell one wall from another. Just as my mind began to reel, footsteps came tramping up behind me, a guided tour making its way through the building.
"Here we have le cabinet de glace."
The guide's voice was flat and bored, and it jerked me back to reality. I was more than happy to move aside so the people on the tour could shuffle in and look around.
"This room was specially designed so that the windows could be covered, as you see, by floor-to-ceiling panels that could be raised or lowered."
"What would be the purpose of that?" I asked. The woman frowned at my butting in on her precious tour without permission.
"Privacy," she said, "and to have better light at night."
"For secret dalliances," said one of the old ladies in the group, and her friends giggled. Ew. Old ladies and secret dalliances were definitely two topics I didn't need mixing together in my brain. I turned to go when one of the tourists lifted her camera and snapped a photo of me.
"Look, it's the girl from the picture,"
she said, showing the image to her friend. The friend said,
"Oh."
What picture? What were they talking about? I felt a knot of unease in my belly. But before I could get up the nerve to ask the woman why she'd randomly snapped a photo of me, the group moved on. Wait till Mom heard that the strangest people I'd met in Paris were a tour bus full of old American ladies. I passed back through the flower bedroom and went downstairs. Outside, I came upon a crisscrossing network of footpaths. A map on the wall showed that they led to something called Le Hameau. A 5-minute walk left me standing at the edge of a tiny fairy tale village. There were houses and mills, and a tiny duck pond, pink flowered shrubs, and footbridges with rough wood handrails. It was basically the last thing you'd expect to find on the grounds of Versailles, the polar opposite of the palace itself. I walked toward the biggest building. Its windows were blocked with wire mesh, and the door looked like it hadn't been opened for years. Peeking through the dirty glass, I could barely make out a black and white tile floor. Behind the house was a garden, with fat heads of cabbage growing in neat rows. The garden was freshly tended, almost like someone was living there. There was also a round turret attached to the house, with a barred metal gate blocking off its entrance. I got the odd feeling that I'd somehow traveled back in time. I half expected to see a peasant woman come out of the house, carrying a heavy wooden bucket to fetch water from the well. As I looked around the garden, the eerie sensation hanging over me like a veil, there was a sound.
Freak.
It sounded like something very old and very stiff being opened for the first time in 100 years. And turning around to look, I saw that the gate to the turret had crept open a few inches, revealing the spiral staircase inside. The locks were obviously there for a very specific reason, to keep tourists out. This was only a fluke, caused by a change in the atmospheric pressure or something, and it wasn't my place to explore inside the fragile old building. Feeling highly virtuous, I walked forward, intending to close it and then report the malfunction to the next employee I saw. But as I went closer to the open doorway, the back of my neck prickled. I felt an almost magnetic pull toward the stairs inside. It couldn't really hurt to go in for a second and see the place from a different perspective, could it? I pushed the gate another 2 inches and slipped inside, stopping at the base of the stairs. Shafts of sunlight, glittering with dust particles, poured in through small rectangular windows. A little round ceiling soared 20 feet above me, supported by wooden beams like the spokes of a wheel. And carved between each pair of beams was a pale blue, spike-petaled flower, almost too faint to see after centuries of existence. Versailles was turning out to be a creepier place than I'd imagined. Feeling slightly nervous, I reached up and fidgeted with my medallion. It was cold against my hand. I heard a footfall behind me and spun around, prepared to apologize and try to weasel my way out of the situation. But I was alone, and the gate had closed when my back was turned. Figuring I'd had my extra allotment of tourism-based thrills, I stepped toward it and pulled. It wouldn't open. I let out a nervous laugh before wrapping my hands around the bars and yanking. Nope. Momentarily stunned, I gave the bars a fruitless shake before taking a step back. I wasn't worried that I'd starve or anything. I mean, this was a major tourist attraction. Somebody was bound to come by before too long. But what would be the consequences of having gone inside this forbidden place? Would I be kicked off the palace grounds? Banned for life? What if I couldn't come back for the party? Why had the gate worked 2 minutes earlier and suddenly gotten stuck? The hinges seemed to be in decent shape, not rusted over or anything. I sighed and looked around, noticing for the first time that there was a door inside the turret, one that led directly toward the ground floor of the building. But when I put my hand on the doorknob and tugged, it didn't budge. A rustling sound came from above me. I glanced up toward the ceiling and saw a sweep of movement over the banister, almost like an arm, the way you'd reach out to steady yourself as you went upstairs. Was someone else in here with me? Had somebody else gotten stuck too? Hello? I called. Who's there? I took a few tentative steps up, testing my weight on each plank before I moved to the next. The last thing I needed was to go crashing through a French national monument. Bonjour? I said. Hello? Silence. I could keep climbing and see if there was another way out, But if there wasn't, and someone came by to find me in an off-limits part of the cottage, I could be in major trouble, which would seriously irritate Hannah and possibly doom me to the social blacklist. Peer pressure got the better of me, so I turned back. At the bottom of the stairs, I stopped. The barred gate was still shut tight, but the second, inside door was wide open. Beyond it lay an expanse of small black and white tiles. It was the same room you could barely see through the dingy front window, and it looked like it hadn't been touched by a human in 100 years. A few pieces of broken furniture, thickly blanketed with dirt and grime, were pushed up against the walls. I felt that same weird, magnetic urge to go inside. It was the same strange feeling I'd had since arriving in Paris, that I somehow belonged in the city. And now it was telling me I belonged inside this strange room. But taking that step seemed like it was going too far, in more than one way. So I stopped short of the threshold. On the far side of the room was a massive hearth, the kind where you'd find a fire with a giant pot of soup boiling over it. Painted on the wall above the hearth was yet another flower. My heart thumping, I backed out into the stairwell and closed the door just as another sound came from above me. I glanced up, and it took me a moment to process what I saw. The woman in the pink dress stood on the landing at the top of the stairs, looking down over the railing. Her eyes were burning bright, and her medallion dangled from her neck.
"Bonjour," I said. "Where did you come from?"
She didn't reply. She just kept staring at me.
"Je suis..."
I mentally searched my meager French vocabulary to find the words to express my stuckness.
"Je suis ici?"
"I am here? Nice, Colette." Her expression didn't change. And next to me, the interior door opened again. By the time I glanced into the tiled room and then back up at the landing, the woman was gone. Was I supposed to follow her? I almost stepped over the threshold, but once again something held me back. Instead of going in, I reached for the doorknob and closed it. Suddenly, I was interrupted by a flurry of voices and turned to see a tour group outside the turret looking in at me.
"What are you doing?"
the tour guide asked me in English, horrified.
"I'm stuck," I said. "I can't get out."
The guide stepped forward, a deep frown on her face.
"How did you get in? That area is absolutely unauthorized."
"The gate was open," I said. "I thought it was part of the tour."
"This gate? Impossible. It is never unlocked."
She grabbed the bars and tried to push the gate, but had no luck. Finally, I tried one last time. It swung open easily. I darted out and slammed it shut with a clank. After giving me a dirty look, the guide went on with her tour as if it had never been interrupted by a juvenile delinquent like myself.
"This was Marie Antoinette's private cottage," she said. "To get away from the pressures of court life, she would put on a simple dress and come here, tend her garden, play with her children, and spend time with her closest friends."
One of the people in the group, a teenage boy, walked up to the gate by the stairwell. I held my breath as he pulled on it. It didn't budge.
"You can't go inside," the guide said, shooting me a death glare. "You'll have to try to peek through the windows. That's as close as anyone gets anymore."
"Anyone but the ghosts," the boy's mother said, winking. "Oh, yes," the guide said, sounding tired.
I forgot about the ghosts. They can come and go as they please.
Still jittery, I left Le Amu, passing a little farm with baby goats playing in their small paddock. The afternoon was quiet, the paths deserted. The dirt crunched beneath my boots as I walked. A light, cool wind lifted the hair on my arms and chilled my skin until I pulled my sleeves down over my palms. I walked all the way back to the main chateau, stood in the center of the courtyard, and turned in a slow circle. I felt out of it, almost dizzy. Soon the group started to gather. Miraculously, Hannah and Peely showed up on time.
"Where have you been, Colette?" Hannah asked.
It was an innocent question, but the answer was complicated. Should I admit that I went off by myself? Should I tell them about getting locked in the turret? I couldn't tell if getting stuck in a 200-year-old stairwell was cool or uncool.
"Just around."
"Did you go to the gift shop? I spent like 50 euros.
Pilar reached into her bag and handed me a black beret, a tin of candies with a picture of the palace on it, a silk scarf, and a postcard. I passed the other items back to her and stared at the postcard, a portrait of an alabaster-skinned woman wearing a square-necked ball gown and high, powdered wig, surrounded by her children. I flipped it over and read the caption. "La Reine Marie Antoinette et ses enfants." Then I flipped it back over and looked at the picture once more. Pilar was babbling on about the beret, but I wasn't listening to her. I kept looking at the postcard until Peely lifted the card from my hands and put it back in the bag. I could still feel the cardstock against my fingers. Most of all, I could still see the face. That unmistakable face. Long, narrow, with a prominent chin, and dark, piercing eyes. I could picture it as well as if I'd spent hours looking at her. Because I kind of had. The woman on the postcard was the same woman I'd been seeing all day. Marie Antoinette, the dead Queen of France. Chapter 5. I don't believe in ghosts. I don't. I don't, I don't, I don't. But I also couldn't shake the feeling that I'd seen one. As we boarded the train back to the city, all I could think about was the woman in the dress, her silence, her medallion, my medallion, around her neck, and that piercingly intense look in her eyes, as if she had something she wanted to say to me. Hannah and Pilar were sitting together, a few rows up. When I plunked into my seat, I'd been too distracted to notice how far away they were. I didn't even notice when someone sat down beside me.
"You are very thoughtful," Jules said. "Did you like Versailles?"
"Yes," I said, blinking back to reality. "It's beautiful."
"I agree," he said. "Although, of course, it's hard to admire it so much when you think about the difficulties of building it, and the peasants who are basically treated like slaves."
"But living there must have been amazing." Jules cocked his head.
"Actually, for anyone but royalty and the very top noble families, it wasn't all that wonderful. Conditions for the rest were often very humble."
"Why did they stay then?" I asked.
"Because the king required it," he said. "He wanted to keep them close by to ensure that they weren't plotting against him. They came to the palace and tried to seek the king's favor when they could, and then spend the rest of their time in elaborate court ceremonies designed to keep them bored and quiet.
Keep your friends close and your enemies closer, I said.
Exactly, Jules replied.
We rode for a few minutes without speaking, but the silence wasn't nearly as awkward as I would have expected it to be. With nothing to distract me, my thoughts turned back to the ghost.
What do you know about Marie Antoinette? I asked.
Jules looked surprised.
Well, all of the things I explained this morning, to start.
I felt a warm flush creep up my cheeks. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. He shrugged.
She was born in Austria, Marie the Dauphin, Louis XVI, at 14 years old. Became queen when her husband rose to the throne after the death of his grandfather. Known for being frivolous and wasteful, out of touch with the people of France.
And then they killed her, right?
She was tried and executed during the revolution, he said. She was sent to the guillotine and beheaded. It is said that she maintained great dignity in the face of death.
At the sound of the word beheaded, I tugged my sweater a little tighter around my shoulders.
What about the little village?
Le Hameau? It was like a playhouse for her. She and her friends would go there and pretend to be peasants. They would tend the gardens, milk the cows. Of course, the cows had to be scrubbed clean before the queen could touch them.
Well, naturally, I said. Who would touch an unscrubbed cow? Jules looked at me then, and the moment lingered. As if, for the first time, he was really seeing me as an individual and not just one of the pack.
What about the flowers? I asked. The spiky ones all over the place?
He looked confused. Then he handed me his notebook.
Can you show me?
As I took his pen, our hands brushed lightly against one another, and I didn't dare look up. I was afraid he'd be able to see me blushing. After I drew the flower,